Hey, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features. Today we have The Texas Heart, which is a very heartwarming film in the end, but kind of, you don't really know at the beginning. And the fabulous director, Daniel Smith, is here. Thank you for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, Simon, but I must make a quick correction. I wrote and produced it, but I did not direct it.
Oh, I'm so bad. Sorry, I have you written down as director. Look how bad I am.
Oh, maybe I should have accepted it, but the guy who directed a fellow named Mark David and also DP'd it might take umbrage at that. But no, I played a big role in casting, and quite, you know, since I produced it, I have a lot of authority, but that did not include directing it.
How come you didn't want to direct it then?
I guess I don't quite trust myself technically. Of course, a DP can help you with camera angles and lighting and all the rest, but I've never been entirely certain that I would be making the right choices about, I think I would be good at actors, but I don't know that I would be good about, you know, the best directors, I think, begin to edit it in their heads while they're making it and can see the film in every shot. And I can see that somewhat, but I might want to start with a short or something and then work my way up. I've just been maybe, in this day and age when anybody can claim they're a director, if they've written the material especially, they think, well, why not direct it? But I wanted somebody with real experience, knowing that we had a 22-day shoot and in the wilds of Charleston, Mississippi, to shoot a film about Texas. That put a premium on making sure there were not any false starts, and we had a real pro running the show.
So before we were off camera, started recording, you said you made a promotional trailer.
I did. I think a lot of indie filmmakers do this now, if they can afford it, because it's not cheap. I think we spent $6,000 or $7,000, which is not nothing. But we felt like to get the attention of other investors and other actors and possible producing partners, managers and agents and all the rest, we thought, you know, it's so hard to get people to read things in Hollywood. Nobody reads, as they say. And so we thought, well, to both to give us a clearer feel for ourselves, I had a co-author, Nick Field, who grew up with me in Texas, and this is where a lot of the characters, this is a weird thing where the story is completely made up, but the characters are actually mostly real. We decided that it made sense to put together some funds and go shoot it with good regional talent in the Dallas area, because we shot it in our hometown mostly, a little town called Wolf City, Texas. It's kind of what I call last picture show country, except now we have color. We shot basically a representative slice of the film. It's not really a trailer, because we decided to put together the scenes we thought would tell a comprehensive story, but do it within like 4 or 5 minutes. And we did, and it did help us find financing. This is where we used Andy Sinsenig, to play Peter, the lead. But by the time, a year and a half later, when we had the funds together to make the movie, he was busy in a TV series called Powers, out of Atlanta. And we couldn't afford him, and he wasn't really available. So we went with a younger guy who had minimal credits, Eric Fellows, but was actually quite good, and put our money into some character actors like John Savage and Lynn Shay from Insidious, Daniela Bobadilla, of course, had done a lot of work with Anger Management, been on that series with Charlie Sheen, and then Jared Abramson, who's been quite a successful actor out of Canada, said Hello Destroyer, and was up for a Canadian Oscar, as a matter of fact, this past year. So we put together a really good ensemble of by indie standards, and the budget we worked with, pretty strong talent, I thought, for what was still a low-budget film.
I just want to say in my notes, I wrote down, Lynn Shay is in this film? I was so excited. I got to tell you that. She made my day seeing her. So was she eager to jump on board?
Yes, she was, and especially playing something out of character like a female mob boss. She really went to town on that, as you could may have noticed in watching it. Hey, we thought we wanted to do something different with a mob boss instead of just some, you know, cliched Italian heavy set guy or whatever. But she had known, and this one of the things I learned that working with someone like Mark David made a big difference, is you realize you can get deals if you got if there's somebody on board, in this case Mark, that they had worked with before. And so they thought, okay, we like the script, but we don't know Dan Smith, and, you know, we don't know hardly anybody else in this, but we've worked with Mark, and we trust him. And so she came, and she did that for like $5,000.
Oh, I don't care. I'm just such a big Lynn Shea fan. So
yeah, she was great, yeah. She's something else.
So did your script come from anything you read in the newspaper, or is this totally out of your head?
Out of our heads. My friend Nick Fields and I have grown up together and gone our separate ways. He's in the world of finance out of in Texas and New York, and I became an academic professor type, and then now I'm just retired writing movies and working on books, but I taught for 30 years at the University of Kentucky. So we went our separate ways. We've been fast friends when we were in high school. We got together about 8 years ago, thanks to Facebook and the internet and so forth, found one another. He was in New York, and he said, man, we had so many crazy things growing up in this little town in North Texas, in Wolf City. We ought to write a book about that. I said, yeah, I thought that was kind of funny. He says, Nick, you've never written a book, and I'd written three of them at that point. But I said, you're right, that would be kind of cool. And then we spent the whole weekend just brainstorming about that. But he said, you know what would be even better, since I know you're working on movies, Dan, why don't we make it a movie? I said, okay, that might be easier. And we started thinking about a good fish-out-of-water story. How can we land somebody in this little crazy backwoods town called, well, we eventually called it Juniper for legal reasons, but it was Wolf City in our mind's eye. And we thought up this story of a mob lawyer on the lam trying to get lost and be off the radar in bumfuck Texas, you know. And then introduced him to the characters. So the lawyer and his plight was made up, but all those other characters are all based on absolutely real people we all knew. So it was a lot of fun to work on it, but it took, of course, like any script that's any good, another year and a half of multiple revisions to get it into the kind of shape we wanted it to be in. We even lost a director in the process, a woman director who I think decided, won't say her name, but I think decided that it was too masculine for her point of view. And that's probably true. It's not there are women in it. There's some strong women in it, but it's not a woman's film by any means. And so we found Mark David, who was very eager to do it. He's also a fellow Texan, but we did not know him until this point in time. He's out of Houston, I think. And we came together and put together a solid team and ended up shooting it in Charleston, Mississippi, because, as you probably can guess, they had production incentives and production and tax credits in ways that Texas does not, or the state I'm in, Missouri, does not. And I live in St. Louis. Mississippi has a 25-30% tax credit, and we shot it in Charleston, which is the hometown of famous actor Morgan Freeman, who we thought we could find a way to get him into the movie, but we never did. But he was friendly with us, and in fact invited Nick and me to come play in a golf tournament he had up there while we were in the middle of our shoot. But as was often customary, as often customary in independent films, when you're running behind, we said we had just reached a crisis about how much time we had, and we had to cut a bunch of scenes and spend 24 straight hours reworking some of the scenes for this next 2 days of shoot. We didn't say, no, Morgan Freeman, we can't come play golf with you. We've got to work on this script some more. So that was one of our opportunities missed to hang with him. But anyway, we had a great time out there.
I guess one of the things I really appreciate indie filmmakers, how do you get your locations? You guys spent a lot of work doing that.
Well, it took several trips. We had a location scout that I picked up from the Mississippi Film Commission who did a pretty good job, sort of narrowed the field down to four or five instead of 14 or 15 places. And then it's not that far for me to drive down from St. Louis to – it's about a six-hour drive to where this was, south of Memphis. And over the course of two long location scouting trips, we found a place that looked about as run down and deracinated as we had imagined our town needed to look. And then the question was, of course, find the right town, but where are you going to put all these people up? The big question you want, why don't you shoot it in L.A. where the actors are, but you may not have the look you want because it's hard to find a small town Texas feel there, or do you want to go to the feel of the town, and then think, oh my God, you fly people from all over the country into what turned out to be the closest place was Memphis, which is 75 miles, but we put them up in a little town called Grenada. There wasn't even a hotel in Charleston, but in 15 miles away there was a Hampton Inn, and we put a cast and crew of about 40 people up for 24 nights. I remember walking out of that hotel with a bill, you know, $37,000, but that's actually a pretty cheap price. We got it for like $50 a night for all these people. And I was afraid these actors and their agents, some of them were jerks, but the actors to a T were wonderful to work with, and they wanted five-star accommodations. I said, hey man, there is no five-star accommodation in Grenada, Mississippi. You're lucky there are any accommodations. It's a Hampton Inn, for crying out loud. So, but that's the way we made the calculated decision to spend money on the location, because we thought the location was part of the story. And instead of, you know, the typical thing is we'll just, you know, shoot it in LA or New York. We've got a massive pool of cast and crew you can tap into, and they'd be coming from home, and they won't be able to fly anybody out and all that stuff. But that's not the kind of show we wanted to make. We wouldn't, relationship film, you know, shot strictly in interiors and all that kind of thing. So, you know, it probably could have been shot slightly cheaper, but I'm not sure because we got a lot of great, cheap labor from a very strong Mississippi, talent pool. The woman that we call the pie lady, Susan McPhail, was wonderful.
You are.
She's in a movie with Nick Nolte, and
you are.
She's quite a good actress, and
I love her.
And she's something. She just steals that scene, you know.
She does.
She's a character actor. She's in the Ben Mendelsohn movie too, called
Mississippi yeah. Something.
Yes, she has. He was a gambler.
Yes, I've seen it.
Yeah, and she's in that. She gets a lot of character parts in pretty good movies, much bigger movies than ours was, but we gave her a slightly bigger role, and I wish I could have made it bigger, but she was a lot of fun to work with, that was her husband, that played her husband in the film, the long-haired guy, that he also gets a lot of character parts. So we had a lot of good, and that was another concern we had, was, okay, we know we're going to get great work out of John Savage and Lynn Shea and Daniela Bobadilla and all these guys, but what happens when you bring them up alongside and they're working in scenes with local people? Is the audience going to notice a big come down in you know, in talent level? And I'm here to say that I don't believe that they might not have recognized these people, but I don't think they thought, oh, they ran out of money and now they had to hire these local people to play these other roles. I think it all worked pretty seamlessly. You know, you didn't know them, but they kept up and played, put out their A game and did a great job. And our biggest find, I thought, of course, was from New York, this guy named Cam Dabrowski, who played Tiger. He was unknown, and still is somewhat of an unknown actor. And New York trained, and spent a lot of time learning about autistic people and the lingo and the way they talked and the way they thought and how their physicality of how they might act. Because, you know, you got to find that right blend where it's clear to the audience that he's slow, but you know, what's that phrase from
Tropic Thunder?
Yeah, don't want to go full retard, you know. So he did a wonderful, I thought he did a magnificent job. I don't know if you had a feeling like that, but I was very impressed with the place he found emotionally and physically to depict this guy.
Now, I do have a couple questions. Let's go over the music. The music was excellent.
Yep, got a guy, named Raymond, who worked in, who was a William Morris. We knew that'd be a lot of money to get somebody to score this, so we thought, well, let's find somebody who's up and coming in one of the major agencies. And this guy did it for a modest amount of money. He loved the idea of it, and I think he thought this could be kind of a nice breakout movie for him. He's ended up continuing to do a lot of work with Lifetime and Hallmark movies, but we made sure he didn't make it kind of schmaltzy and too cornball. We wanted to have a little twang to it, but I thought he found the right grace notes for that without being too obvious. You know, it's like anything else you want. You're depicting two worlds coming together here, and I thought musically he found the right way to do that. I really liked I think the music really helped a lot. I think the music, if it's done poorly, it takes you out of the movie. But if it's done, it's like costuming. You don't really think about it. But if it's done well, then it really makes the whole thing come together. And you can talk about it later. But if you're sitting there talking about the music in the movie, well, you know, like, what's his name? What does a lot of Spielberg movies.
John Williams?
Yeah, John Williams. Yeah, he's a wonderful composer, but sometimes it's like there's a lot of bombast there. And, of course, that's big screen tentpole movies where you kind of half expect it. They're very big action adventure pieces, but still, I find myself feeling like that we're like he's calling attention to the music, and I don't think that really happened much in Texas Heart, so I was pleased with what he did.
Now, I do want to talk about the pecan pie.
Oh, the pecan pie, yeah.
Was it that good? Did you guys actually eat it, or you just bought it and put it on the table?
He ate it. In fact, he almost got sick because we did about 8 or 9 takes of that thing, and all he could do was make sure he took small enough bites. But it was you know, we got the people who took care of our daily meals and so forth were local folks who, you know, I'm sure it's like dinner on the ground, you know, a lot of fried pies. I mean, actually, some of the L.A. people got kind of tired of it. They said, where's my vegan food, you know. But for the purposes of that scene, they really knew how to make great pie. So Eric made a big mistake because he started thinking, okay, I'll get this in the first take or two. And he was taking big bites. And after a while, he was like, man, I'm just full to the brim.
Yeah.
It was delicious eating up to a point. And then I think they were desperate for a little bit of sushi and, you know, healthier style eating, because this was Mississippi Delta food, you know, all the way down the line. But it worked in that scene. It felt like, you know, this. You felt like the pie lady knew how to make pie, and she had used pie the way some people use liquor to get him to open up about his life. You know, it's very effective, I thought.
So when you were shooting the football team stadium, you had no issues doing that? Because that's a pretty big shot.
Oh, we had issues. Oh, my God. I thought we did a somewhat artful job of dealing with the fact that we only had about 80 people there. We needed to have this is the one case where the local people just were not – they were thrilled to be part of this movie, but they didn't know that movie extra work involves sitting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And sitting and being part of those, and we actually had a king in his court, you know, the halftime show, you know, was supposed to be like 4 girls and then the queen. And the girls, all but one of them said, I can't take this anymore, and they just left, as did about half of our extras in the stands. So I had to go out and record. I was the football announcer, by the way, PA announcer. And fortunately unseen, but heard. And we had to kind of rewrite the script to cover the fact that we're not really showing all these women, these young girls, you know, who are with the queen coming out and marching up and so forth, because they weren't there. We said one. So we cut to the finale of it when she was finally crowned. And I think it worked okay, but it really ticked me off, because this is where our location scout and our extras, casting director, utterly failed to convey the right sense of discipline to the folks, which, you know, this is the opposite of when you're in New York or LA. They understand all this. It was a cold, cold night. They'd already had their coffee and their hot chocolate and a little meal from us, and it's 9 or 9:30. They wanted to go to bed and go home. It was cold. And it's like, we're making a movie here, man. Come on, stay. And we lost almost half the crowd, and I think it's kudos to the way Mark shot it. And everybody else who stayed as troopers, the scene still worked, but it was a frantic, frantic hour. So what are we going to do with half of our extras having hit the road, you know? It's indie filmmaking on the bad side, you know?
It happens. I also want to talk about the spirit shop. I have a note saying no bags.
What now?
The Goodwill.
The Goodwill.
He went to the Goodwill to buy clothes.
Oh, yeah. That was what the guy that walked by with his shirt off and said, I forget the line he used, he was one of our big investors. So that was his moment of aside, you know, to get that little scene. I don't know why he wanted to play that massively hicky guy, but he did it with aplomb, even though the guy is from L.A., but he I guess, watched enough TV and channeled that kind of small town fuck you-ness or whatever. But, yeah, that was that was a place we called Walsmart. We weren't allowed to call it Walmart, so we called it Walsmart, which actually was the name of the town. That was the name of the place. It was Walls something Mart. So okay. We just called it Walsmart. And we had a good time shooting that sequence in there because it helped sort of show Eric playing Peter, you know, how do you make this transition into this fish out of water scenario where you have to start to look the part, dress the part, and you know, we wanted to combine a lot of humor in what was otherwise for him a disorienting, scary thing because he knew nobody and he was on the run.
Now, I do have a small question about the film. If I missed it, you're going to have to correct me. How did Lynn Shay find the lawyer?
Well, he did have a cell phone.
He
didn't realize they were in L.A. He didn't know that much they were in L.A. And they had he made a mistake of leaving behind information on the phone to his girlfriend. Okay. Remember, they went out to the sea. And that allowed them to trace back where that phone call was to, what town it was.
Okay.
We didn't show every jot and tittle of that process, but I guess maybe in your case, we didn't do it enough of a procedural.
That's why I'm asking. I just like to ask these questions.
That's a good question, but that's why that scene when they come and basically kill her, they got her phone.
Okay. And that's what I wanted to know.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm looking for, I just need a line saying, hey, we got her phone. And I would have clicked in at that point. But that's just me. Maybe it was just me as my observation. I missed that.
Well, we probably made it too visual. What we did do is we made a point of a Trent Tackberry's guy that played one of the two hired muscle for Lynn Shay, made a big point of showing him pick up her phone. But okay. Maybe it would be better to have him say to them, hey, I got the phone, guys.
Yeah.
Just to underscore the fact that we can now find this guy.
So, when you wrote this film, did you want your lawyer to have a heart?
We wanted him to see if he could find one. Yeah, I mean, the danger in something like this, especially when you call it Texas Heart, is that too much of the surprise has gone out of it. But you know, it's more of how did it happen, not what happened. Because usually, if we face it, most fish out of water stories end up with a person feeling okay about the water he's in, you know. But we wanted to make the story with Tiger have some strong reveals and unexpected moments in it where he has some real choices, where he could have and almost did opt out of it because, you know, the noose was getting closer in on him by the time he decided, made the fateful decision to take on Tiger's case, because then he realized, okay, it's going to get out in the press, and it's going to make it way easier for them to find me.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's how they found him.
Yeah, that's how they found him. He got on the TV and so forth, and what's his name? Michael LaCour, the guy that played one of the bigger, more muscular thug. He says, you're not going to believe this, Ms. Smith, because he was showering and toweling off, and he saw this thing on the local TV and realized, okay, this guy's an idiot. We've got him dead to rights now. But I still think there were a few surprises in there for people. It's just that you know, this isn't a it's kind of a legal crime thriller, but just as much a dramedy about character driven stories. In essence, as I think about it, you know, a year or two after we first shot it, it's. I'm proud of what we did, and I think we made it nice and complex. But on the negative side, I think there were some tonal shifts that some people might think, well, wait a minute, is this really a thriller, or is it a courtroom drama, or is it a dramedy of small-town life? And the answer is it's all those things, but what to me is a happy combination for other people could be disorienting and off-putting. I don't know. It's mainly done well, but you know, there are people, I'm sure, that don't like it.
Okay, well, since you've gone there, I'm going to go with you. I'm going to continue on what you're saying. I think most people would feel that way during the third act of the film, the last act. when you throw in a little, when somebody goes missing, I don't want to ruin the film for somebody, so I'll try to do non-spoilers. When somebody goes missing and you introduce a new subplot, I find the film takes a definite change.
Yeah, that's true.
And, I mean, I don't want to ruin it and that kind of thing. Because I just thought, okay, it definitely does take a change for me at that point. And that introduces a whole new aspect to the film. And at that point, I felt you had two different films going.
Well, at one level, that's true, because we had a guy trying to escape his past and see if he could fit in and keep hiding from who was after him. Whereas here's a girl who's trying to, we find out eventually, and this is why it's so confusing.
Don't ruin it.
She was trying to escape her past.
Well, I think we know that. I think that's definitely stated in your flashback scenes.
Yeah. So to me, it does tie up together in that sense, that it's both about people running, you know, like our tagline, not to be too corny about it, is you can't run from your heart. That's really what both of them were trying to do. Of course, in her case, it was more a sense of urgency because her dad was such a – John Savage did a great job playing a drunk, I think, seriously. But he had a heart for her. He had a certain kind of love for her, but it was obviously a totally controlling kind of thing. And scary, considering his problem with drinking and so forth. So her departure wasn't – her running from that scene was not surprising. Just as Eric's, from when you lose a case for the mob and you're a lawyer, you better hit the road, buddy. So they both had, it's about, and that's why the fact that they came together and they had, so we had to be careful that, because he's a very good looking guy and she's a good looking girl and he wasn't that much older than her, that we didn't want to make this turn into a romantic thing. It could easily have done so. So we had to kind of make sure he played it as almost like a much older brother kind of wisdom he was imparting to her. But that's how we tried to stitch those otherwise, as you say, two different kinds of movie trajectories, a fish out of water guy and then this missing girl scenario together.
I want to back you up for a second. I did feel you were definitely going for the romantic thing when it first started, because she's walking down the road, he's driving the car. And I really felt you were going to go there. Then I'm like, nope, they're not going there. So I like that. That was something different. That was good.
Yeah.
Because you led me down that path that they were going to be kissing, making out in that car, and I totally expected that.
Yeah, that was we shot that old-fashioned style with inside a big, huge garage warehouse type setting, and did it with you know, passing lights over and so forth. We didn't have the money for a moving car sequence.
The car wasn't moving?
It looked pretty good.
That looked amazing, because I thought the car was moving.
Yeah, and it was just sitting in the room. And, you know, she, we did have lots of conversations with Daniela, who played Allison. And to some extent, the guy that played Roy and Tiger, we had conversations about maybe a different kind of ending. Like maybe she should have come back into town. And I thought, well, that means the movie's really about her, and it isn't. I don't think she liked the fact that we ended at Malibu, but we set it up that way. And we wanted her to start a new life for herself. And to come back and get back together with her dad or somehow have some of that, it would be really kind of anticlimactic. It might be interesting, and you know, and I'm sure John Savage liked the extra screen time, but I think by then he already left the set. But it felt like that we needed to end it with him still on the lam, basically. That was a more realistic kind of thing. But he had learned a lot, and you know, and decided to kind of change his ways, I guess, enough that it had enough of a sense of resolution and closure for him. We did have to make sure that she asked about Tiger and on the other hand was reassured by Peter that he would let her father know that she was okay and the other people had Tiger and all the rest, which caused, I don't know if you call that exposition or not, but it did require us to do what we wanted to do. This is why they were saying, why don't we ever come back into town? Then you don't have to have any of those conversations. There she is. But then that makes the movie about her at the end. And I just think that's, talk about a movie having a tonal change. It's like here's somebody you don't even meet until halfway through the movie and you find out it's all about her. And it really isn't.
No, I thought it was weird that he did go back to L.A. at the end of the film.
You thought it was weird that he did?
I'm like, what are you doing here? Of all the places not to go is where you started.
Well, he started in Miami, but they did know that he could be in L.A. But I guess our thought was this is where he wanted to go to start over again, and we weren't trying to create the feeling that, aha, he found the perfect place to escape forever. He wasn't trying to escape forever. He just thought, this is what, I love the beach. I want to go back there. And I think other than we made sure he wasn't trying to be a lawyer like that again, he might or might not escape the clutches of Lynn Shea. In fact, he says in the voiceover, I know they're out there. I know they're going to get me, but that's just, this is where he wanted to go.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's kind of fatalistic. You might say it's not very smart, but it was, it provided emotional comfort to him because I think he realized in this whole course of the movie and running to Texas is not, if you can't lose yourself in bumfuck Texas, then you can't lose yourself anywhere, mm-hmm. really. But that's a conceit of it.
Couple more things. Did you have a casting agent? You said you were the casting agent, correct?
No. We used, and this is where Nina comes up. I remember I was shocked to see she used Adrienne Stern also. She did not all the casting, quite frankly. Some of the big names we got, Lynn and John Savage and one other person. Well, Eric, he's not a big name, the lead, came through Mark David. They were all his friends. And that's where I learned the virtue of, hey, even though we had a lot of cool people read for this thing, I learned that even a small budget film like this, people want to work. I mean, you're not going to get A-listers reading, but a lot of high B-list people would read for it. And I was flabbergasted by that because I thought, we're not paying that much and don't you have big TV shows to be working on and all the rest. But they knew it was only a couple of weeks out of the summer and they're always looking to change their profile and be the lead or a supporting player in a feature film and they're otherwise stuck in TV contracts. I didn't always get along with Adrienne Stern, but she did do a good job with finding Jared, played Roy, and most importantly, finding Tiger. Cam Dabrowski was a wonderful find. So I give her the gun. And Daniela. See, there's three main people that she found. We had a Mississippi casting person to help us, and I came out and sort of personally cast some of the Mississippi people. But it was important to have a casting director because she helped give us legitimacy with the agencies to get people to submit and audition in the first place. I'm a big believer that if you've got a really low budget, you're not a big name, which I wasn't and I'm not, you better get somebody in the industry who has access to talent, who they respect, and when they say, hey, they're going to go into production, it's X amount of money, but they're going to shoot it these 3 weeks, and it's a great story, it's wonderful character-driven piece, as she often said, for people, great acting opportunities. And it worked. We had a lot of people audition for the thing. A lot of them.
Last question for you. How did you raise the money for your film?
Well, I put in some. My partner, Nick Field, put in some. And the old rule about, first oar or two in the water attracts other oars, and that led to the rest of it, piecemeal here and there. And like a lot of projects, we were able to collateralize our Mississippi spend and use it as upfront money for the show itself. Of course, we ended up cannibalizing our post-production money because we ended up shooting using almost all our money to make the movie itself, produce it. So we had to go out for another round of investment opportunities to some of the same people, and to their credit, they came through one guy by way of a loan, but nonetheless, we got the money and were able to, pay for all the post-production costs. But we had no money for marketing, which was a big, big mistake. You should always reverse engineer and start with marketing and then work your way back because we had no. I happen to believe it's a good film. It's kind of an audience friendly film. I think audiences, because we did it at the Oxford Film Festival and some other places, audiences just ate it up. Now, critics mostly liked it, but some, you know, had some quarrels with it, which, you know, I understand. Got a very good review of the LA Times out of it. But we didn't have the money to do even a basic theatrical, even 6 or 8 screens or anything. And that meant our VOD possibilities got diminished a lot because, you know, they want to see some of that. So we had to go, and I think we made a good decision considering the limitations we had and the mistakes we had made, to be honest. We made a good decision in distribution with Indie Rights because they do a wonderful job for low-budget films like this by using a very robust and savvy social media campaign to get the word out. And it's doing very well on Amazon and, you know, iTunes and all the other platforms.
Good. So, are you ready for some fun questions?
I'll do my best to answer, yeah. I don't know.
Because I make them up, and now I just change them all the time for people. Okay, number one thing I should do in Texas.
Well, you gotta eat some real, real barbecue. I'm sorry. I don't know what kind of barbecue you've been eating, but it's not the real thing. And that, by that, we mean beef brisket.
Yeah. Number two, the biggest steak you've ever eaten.
I can tell you the biggest steak I ever saw being eaten, and then I thought about it, and then I realized I'm not man enough to do it. I played baseball at Oklahoma State University, and we went on a road trip down into Texas, and in Amarillo, they have this deal where if you can eat the 64-ounce steak, 64 ounces, it's free. And two of our baseball players are big hulking guys. One guy made it. He looked sick as a dog. The other guy started puking right there in the restaurant. So I realized, okay, I'm a 16-ounce guy. That's it. As far as I can go.
I've eaten
watching somebody 64 ounces, that was a sign I don't want to revisit.
I've eaten a 42-ounce, no problem.
Have you? No problem?
No problem.
Was it a sirloin?
It was a sirloin. It was a long story. I'll tell you off air. Number three, favorite mob movie.
Oh, I call it my movie because it's so much like our movie in some ways. My Cousin Vinny.
Sure.
It's hilarious. It's stupid. But it's a comic, silly version of what we made in some respects. I mean, that, of course, to liken ourselves to a big hit movie like that was. I mean, in terms of the setup. But I just thought that everybody, what's the female lead's name in that movie?
Oh, my God.
Marissa Tomei.
Yes, correct.
She's become a really, I think, she still doesn't get the kind of work she should get, even though she's very, very busy. But I just thought she just tore it up. She was terrific in that.
So you've just told us I can find your film on Amazon.
You can on Amazon Prime.
Anywhere else?
Oh, yeah, iTunes, Vudu, you name the platform, I think it's on it. There's only 15 or 20 of them.
Perfect. So everybody, please go watch this film, A Texas Heart. It's great. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Simon. It's been great talking with you.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page. Thank you.